find out the stories behind the songs from your favorite artists.
Like, oh, I fell on my guitar and that made a cool sound. Should we make that a song?
Undebatable with Mark Goodman and Alan Light.
Welcome back. It's Debatable. And that is one of my favorite songs by this writer. I just love Divinyls. Here's the spiel for you.
Just run. Just do it. I'll just get it out of the way.
After founding bands like Spider and Device, Holly Knight would go on to write or co-write huge hits for Pat Benatar, Tina Turner, Heart, Rod Stewart, Divinyls, Scandal, John Waite. I could go on and on and on. In addition, she's written the theme to the TV show Angel, as well as writing and producing the theme to Still Standing, all of which got her inducted into the Songwriters Hall of Fame in 2013. I got to give it up for one of my favorite writers of all time, Holly Knight. Welcome, Holly.
Hi, howdy.
Welcome.
Thank you so much for coming in. I'm glad we somehow could coordinate all of this.
My pleasure.
As I've said to Holly, she is somebody who I do rave about on the 80s because every other song seems is one of yours, it seems. But I mean, you've formed bands, you've been in bands, but I have to, you're known as a songwriter. How do you consider yourself? What do you call yourself?
I call myself a songwriter. First and foremost, I am a musician. I started out that way, but I think after I started having hits, I kind of said to myself, you know, you don't need to be in a band right now. Just call yourself a songwriter because it seems to be happening all around you. So own it, you know.
And was that a shift? Was that an adjustment in the way that you thought of yourself
to
shift that lane? Yeah,
absolutely. Because when I was growing up, well, first let me say I started piano when I was four. I studied classical for 10 years, and my mother was trying to groom me to be a concert pianist. And then, of course, I discovered rock music, and the louder the better. And so I had my own dreams. And really, at that time, I just wanted to be a rock star in a band and play keyboards, you know. But when I joined Spider and we were writing for our first record, we would send the music in to the label, and we wouldn't tell them who wrote what, and they would always pick my songs as the singles. So I think I was given an indication at that point that
something was happening.
Something was going on. Yeah.
I'm not sure how many people really get the sort of the development of Holly Knight. I mean, you were sort of a protege, I guess you could say, of you were spotted, I guess, by Mike Chapman. And
no, he was spotted by me, actually.
Okay. Well,
I was hunting him down.
The story.
We didn't have the internet back then. And my manager was Bill Coyne, who, of course, managed Kiss at the time and then later Billy Idol. And so, I had mentioned it to him, but we really weren't getting anywhere. And we became the band, the house band of a really exciting club at the time called Trax.
Mm-hmm. And my neighborhood.
Yeah, mine too. And we became the house band and I don't know. It's like people would come in, they would play the Madison Square Garden or some other venue, and afterwards they would come in. So we were playing to people like, you know, Mick Jagger and Bowie's in the audience and all this crazy stuff. And then one day I went to a party there that we played at, and it was for the New Barbarians, which was Keith Richards' solo tour thing. And someone introduced me to Mike, and I didn't know it was Mike Chapman, so we were just talking, and then he went off to the bar to get a drink, and someone said, that Mike Chapman, he's having hits all over, and I was like, what? That was Mike Chapman? Huh. And then the drummer in the band Spider is a well-known drummer now. His name's Anton Figg.
Yeah.
And I asked him if he had a tape on him, because we had just made a cassette, a demo. We were trying to get a record deal. And we were looking for producers. And there's three South Africans in that band, and they were hanging out a lot with Eddie Kramer, because he was South African. And they were really keen on using him. You know, he produced the legendary Hendrix.
Yes.
But I really wanted to get with a producer that was a songwriter. And I had heard about Mike Chapman. And so when I heard that he was at the club, I practically strangled Anton to give me the tape. He didn't want to give it to me. And I'm like, are you crazy? So I gave him the tape. I got the tape from him, and I chased after Mike. And I said, would you listen to this? And then that's how our relationship started, you know. Then when I left the band after two records, I went to him and I said, look, I don't want you to be upset because I know you put a lot of money into this band, but I'm not happy. You know, there were internal problems. And if you think Fleetwood Mac had, like, a lot of problems, you have no idea. I mean, the lead singer now has a child by the guitarist and the drummer in that band.
Alrighty.
And right now, now they're divorced, and Anton and Keith Lenton, the guitars, are still best friends. They don't really talk to her, but anyway, so that's really kind of what happened. I was leaving the band, and I said, what should I do? And he said, move out to L.A. Mm-hmm. I'll sign you to a new publishing deal. We'll write together. I'll put you together. You know, he had worked with Nick Gilder on Hot Child in the City, so he put me together with him, mm-hmm. and we wrote The Warrior, you know. And basically, the first day that I went over to write at his house, he got this phone call, and I heard him saying, it's great to talk to you. Yeah. Well, I'm here with Holly Knight. She's a new writer that I signed to a publishing deal, and we're going to be writing a lot. She came over today, and we're going to write you a hit. And he hangs up, and I look at him, and I said, who was that? He says, it was Pat Benatar. And that was the day we wrote Love is a Battlefield.
Amazing.
I mean, that's what are the odds? I mean, it sounds like, you know.
Well, in that moment, what became that moment of writing all those, you know, those songs, what was the method, but how many were written for these artists? How many were written and then matched later? Like, how was that shaking out, especially once people start coming to you for the magic? You know, are you somebody who writes
question. Because what happened was, in the beginning, I was getting covers, meaning people were recording songs they heard. Some of them had already been recorded by Spider, like there was Better Be Good to Me. And 6 months after I left the band, Tina Turner heard it in a playback meeting. And,
thank God.
Yeah, right? I mean, oh my God. And she's been my muse, because over the years she's cut 9 of my songs, more than any other artist I worked with. And then John Waite heard Change, which was another Spider tune, and he recorded that. So it kind of started out that way. And actually the first cover I ever, ever, ever got was while I was still in Spider with Link Wray. And Link Wray did, you know, he's from a whole nother era. And
yeah.
Keith and Anton had been doing a lot of touring with him on the side. So he heard a song that I wrote actually in Spider, which he cut. But I don't even know if that one ever came out or saw the light of day. He was known for this sort of 50s rumble. Rumble.
Link Wray rumble.
Well, for the listeners that don't know who he is. You know, so, but then what happened was, after the thing with Benatar, I started getting requests to write for people, you know. And so when Patti Smyth did the Scandal record, Mike was producing it, and he said, I need songs. We need to hit songs. And, you know, so I wrote The Warrior. He put me together with Nick Gilder, which was kind of funny because I don't know why. I think it's because Nick sounded like a woman. I thought I was getting together to write with a woman, even though the name was Nick, which I thought, well, maybe it was for Nikki or something, you know. And then I met him, and we wrote The Warrior. And I remember I gave it to Mike Chapman, and he just, like, didn't respond. Or he just wasn't in a listening mood that day. So he kind of passed over it. And then he called me up, like, a couple of weeks later and said, well, where's that song that you sent me before? I want to listen to it again. And then he listened to it again, and it became one of my biggest songs.
How different was the demo from what you wound up with the Pat Benatar version?
It was pretty much the same. I mean, it was more like a live performance, because when I did it with Nick, we programmed the drums, and Nick sung on it. Mm-hmm. And it sounded so great with Nick that he hadn't heard of Patty at the time. He didn't want to give it to her after he wrote it. And I said, well, but we wrote it for her, and you know, you can't do that.
Right.
And so he was not really happy about it. Now he's happy about it. You know, he's thrilled, you know. But he sounded amazing on it, too. I still have the demo. Maybe I'll send it to you. You
can always,
if you ever want to hear the demos, you could play some of these demos. Some of them are pretty rough, but it's kind of interesting.
I think that's like a show.
Yeah.
I think that it's so fascinating to hear how a song progresses.
Goes fact, from, yeah.
Now, sure. I want you mentioned Love is a Battlefield. Mm. Excuse me. And I wanted to play your version. And if that's okay.
Do you have
see
to
see the face?
let's just play a little bit of Holly Knight doing her song Love is a Battlefield. So, as a songwriter, when you start with that and you hand it off, mm-hmm. is that just handing off a song? Do you is that difficult for you? Was it back then? Is it different now?
Knowing that they're going to take it where they're going to take it from there.
Well, it's not hard because I'm a songwriter, and that's what you do. That being said, the demo that I did with Mike. Because I recorded that years later, mm-hmm. and I don't know why I sped it up, but I did. It was a little slower. It was more sort of...
And then Neil sped it up even more than that.
Oh, yeah. Well, when we heard it, we hated it, and they know that. You know, we were like, what? Because there were all these synthesizer bells and whistles and noises. There was this weird thing after it went Love is a Battlefield, we'd go, like some weird sound, and I wasn't sure what that was. But, you know, in all fairness, it became a big hit. Even the video, which I thought was... A little cheesy.
It's classic.
It's classic.
Come on.
It is.
Nobody dances like Pat Benatar right? in that video.
And it is. I love it now. And I love her version of it. And, you know, sometimes it just takes a little bit of getting used to. But I've had that song covered so many times. I have to tell you, I just heard a cover the other day by an actor named Luke Evans, mm-hmm. he's from Wales or something, and gorgeous. But he actually, for an actor, he sings pretty damn good. I'm surprised. And his version is closer to the demo than Benatar's, which he never heard the demo. So I thought someone was doing something right there. And then there you go. See how gorgeous he is?
Oh, I know that dude.
Yeah, right? And also I've done another version of my own that has been used several times on TV shows like the reboot of Dynasty. That's more like a Nine Inch Nails version. Mm-hmm. And a young, unknown... singer sings on it, and it's very cool too. So, you know, a good song could be done in any number of ways, you know.
So you said you mentioned Tina as your guardian angel through this, and I guess that's what brings you to town. The Tina show on Broadway.
Talk
about that relationship and that set of songs, mm-hmm. and what it is to either have your stuff, you know, noticed and pulled out by an icon like that, or mm-hmm. then to start to work for, you know, towards something for that voice.
Well, Tina, you know, she did Better Be Good to Me, and the whole record was, you know, exploded. We all know the history of that and everything. But then what happened was she started doing other projects, and Roger Davies, her manager, would call up and say, I'll give you an example. She was in the Mad Max movie Beyond Thunderdome, and she played this badass character named Auntie Entity.
Yes.
And they needed a song for it. So at this point, she'd already won the Grammy of the Year for the record. She'd won a Grammy for Best Rock Vocalist for specifically Better Be Good to Me. And I hadn't met her. And not that that's unusual. I mean, basically, you're a songwriter. You submit a song, and then that's kind of it. You hear it. Or, you know, mm-hmm. Sometimes you're happy with the way they cut it, which most of the times I was always very happy with the covers. Every now and then I would hand a hit song or what I thought potentially was a hit song to someone, and they would, just for the hell of it, turn it into an album track so they could put their own stamp on it, which was really annoying. The thing that was great about Tina was she always copied my demos, like down to everything, you know? So if you were ever to listen to the original version, which you can find on YouTube for Better Be Good to Me, that was performed by Spider and the lead singer, you will see that it is, I mean, ours is a little more druggy sounding, which I like. You know, that's a Mike Chapman production. And had the band stayed together, that was the direction we were going to go in, and it would have been cool. But lots of, do you remember the Paola time where the Exposure came out and everybody fell to the wayside and nobody could get played on the radio? Well, that was when our second record came out. So between that and various other things, that's when I left the band. And, you know, that was my journey. It was meant to happen, you know. But going back to the thing with Tina, I never met her. But Roger asked me to write this song, so I wrote a song called One of the Living, which was like this apocalyptic sort of metal cruncher, really guitar-driven. And I said to him, they had to have it out by a certain time because there were that's a tongue twister.
That's a blockbuster.
Say that five times. Anyway, they wanted it out by a certain time. So she was on tour in Europe, and he said, I said to him, why don't we cut the song ahead of time, and then when she comes back, she can walk in, boom, the song will be done. He said, that's a great idea. So I hired the guitars from my band Device, and we were going to cut it with Mike Chapman. I said, there's one problem. I said, and he goes, what? I said, we need to get the right key. And he goes, oh. He says, he's thinking, and he goes, well, why don't you do a verse and a chorus in five different keys? I'm going to go to London tomorrow. I'm seeing her and catching up with the tour, and I'll give it to her, and we'll let you know what key to cut it in. And I said, no. And he goes, well, what do you mean? And I said, well, look, two things. And this will date me, but I said, what if her Walkman is running at a different speed because the batteries are half dead? It's going to be the wrong key. And there's two different, you know, currencies, electrical currencies running between the countries, so that won't be accurate either. And it'd be terrible if she comes in to sing and it's the wrong key. So that's not going to work. He goes, do you have a passport? I said, yeah. And he goes, well, pack your bags. You're coming to London with me tomorrow. And that's how I met the Acid Queen. That's how I met her for the first time. She actually came to the airport and picked us up. And the next day, we went over the key and figured it out in 5 minutes. And I realized if you count going there and back, I had just traveled over 10,000 miles for a 5-minute meeting. And I thought, God, I don't want to go back. I don't have to cut it right away. So what am I going to do? And she just sort of read my mind and looked at me. She said, why don't you come on tour with us for a few days before you have to go back? So I went on tour. I got to sit in the best seat in the house on a road case on the side of the stage and see her perform and perform Better Be Good to Me. And that's when it hit me. That's when it really hit me that I was really starting to, I could actually do this for a living and have a career as it. And then, so all the other songs that I've written, you know, I had 4 songs on the Foreign Affair record. The best is the signature song for her, and that's the big moment in the musical. Everybody jumps out of their seat. I mean, it's all over the internet now. They've got like Oprah who went there with her and Gail King, and they're lip syncing, and it's like, it's so cool to watch that, you know. I'm just getting such a kick out of it. But I didn't actually write the best for her. I wrote it for someone else, and then Bonnie Tyler, who was not the person I wrote it for, I actually wrote it for Paul Young.
Really?
And they passed on it, which I tease him about even to this day. I just
saw Paul this weekend.
Did you? I saw him about a year ago. Yeah. And he really doesn't like to be reminded that he passed on it. That's okay, because, you know, Clive Davis wrote me and basically said he didn't think it was a hit. So
yeah. See, he doesn't get everything right.
Right. So anyway, Bonnie Tyler cut it. And then she heard it and said she wanted to cut it. Someone pitched it to her. And then what happened was, she said, I want to cut it, but I need a, I can't do her voice, but I need a bridge. And I also wanted to go up in key so I can really rip, you know. And I said, okay. So got together with Mike Chapman. We rewrote it. And she was absolutely right. I mean, it was so much better once we changed that.
Right. I think people associate you with empowering songs and female empowerment. Half the stuff that we've been talking about is about that. And Mike Chapman was known for working with women in particular. I don't know if there is any link between those two things, but did you, as a songwriter, was there a moment when you turned around and thought, wow, the last 5 songs I wrote have that kind of feel to them? Or was it a conscious thing to write songs for women that would be different than the kind of stuff that they had been handed previously?
That's a great question. And the answer is, I always wrote what I felt and sort of, you know, you're trying to catch lightning in a bottle and you're tapping into the ether. And I never deliberately set out to write those kind of songs. And what happened was, back then, I did an interview, and someone said, yeah, you know, a lot of your songs have titles about fighting. There's a lot of songs about fighting. And I said, no, they're not. I write a lot of different songs. And then I went home, and I looked, and I was like, Love is a Battlefield, Invincible, The Warrior, Better Be. I thought, huh, that's interesting. And if you knew my past, it would make a lot of sense. But the point is, it was not about fighting with someone. It was about fighting for something. And I'm still to this day always fighting for something, which is individuality and the right to be who I am and not worry about what everybody else thinks. You know, I'm doing a musical now, actually, and that's really the ethos of the whole piece, is just screw all the cynics, you know? Because if J.K. Rowling or Alanis Morissette had listened to people, well, she wouldn't be opening up her musical in a few days.
That's right.
You know, and you don't know why people say what they do. You have no idea. You can't even personalize it. You know, you don't know if they woke up and lost in the stock market that day, or woke up with, you know, hemorrhoids or whatever. You can't listen to people.
So are you working on a musical out of your catalog, or writing from zero, or somewhere between?
I'm doing two. So one is completely original, and then the other one is... It's semi-autobiographical. Like, if you think of, for instance, Almost Famous, it's about Cameron Crowe, but it's a fictional character and sort of a fictional story. So that's kind of how mine is. But it is definitely, what's different about it from all the other musicals is it really, really embraces the MTV generation. It's very edgy, and it's, that whole time period is very, you know, it's unto itself a different time period, you know? It was a feel-good time, I think, and, you know, there was
strangely, but yes.
Yeah, but there was, like, a lot of craziness. Like, I always thought, like, why the shit that they would put in those videos, like, were so random, like cows walking through the room, or just things that had nothing to do with the song. I mean, have you seen the video to The Warrior?
Yes.
Okay, so Patty and I sat down. She, you know what, when I got inducted into the Songwriting Hall of Fame in 2013, she sung The Warrior at the event, and she, you know, she inducted me. And so we met up before that, and we started talking about the video, and she was just saying how she hated it, and it was like she didn't know, like, why they did that, and they made her up to look that way. But that's the 80s for you, you know what I mean? Like, obsession was like all these Romans in togas giving out hors d'oeuvres at a pool party. And, you know, that's the 80s. But so
I feel
this
like I have to apologize
like
for some reason. I don't know. It's not my fault, but I feel like it's my fault somehow. That's very funny, actually.
I just have to read this tweet because you winced when Mark said we were going to play the Your Love is a Battlefield.
Yeah.
But I got a tweet from 17 Candles says, dude, that original version was slick. Love is a Battlefield. I'm definitely going back to that. That could be mixed into a techno set and blow everyone's mind.
I love that.
Wow.
I'm just, you know what, I'm really hard on myself as a singer. I mean, I've sung on a lot of backups. I've sung, it's really weird. I sung backups on One of the Living, standing next to Tina Turner, and I can't tell you how intimidating that was. And then I sung on Love Touch for Rod Stewart, and he made me sing all the backgrounds before he'd sing the lead. Again, that was kind of intimidating, but I did it, you know. But to be truthful, if I was really as good as those singers that I wrote for, I would have been a singer. You know, that wasn't my thing. And I kind of like being behind the scenes and the autonomy that comes with it. But it's a double-edged sword because there is autonomy, but there's also the thing where you get shoved to the side and no one wants to mention you. Like,
yeah.
A lot of these performers would like people to think that they wrote the songs.
Yes. We're going to let you go. But I didn't get a chance to play this yet. And we talked when we were sort of communicating, trying to work this out. You sent me a song that you said it on purpose. You hadn't put it up online because you were hoping somebody would cover this song. Have you found anyone yet?
No, but I have my idea of who I'd like to cut it.
I want to
think Miley Cyrus would be a good candidate. It's
in
my musical. Halsey could sing it. She says fucking Halsey, everything.
Halsey could crush it. We got to go here. I'm going to play this 30 seconds. I want to say, take a listen to this, and I want to say thank you, Holly Knight, for coming in. And if you are an amazing singer who's looking for a song, maybe this is the song. Let's see. O-M-F.
No, A-M-F.
A-M-F. Yo-Yo.
It's an anagram.
It is an anagram, indeed, but I just couldn't come up with it in my head there. Adios, motherfucker. You're on your own.
Yeah, baby.
Who's singing on this one?
Oh, Lena Hall, who is an amazing rock singer. She won the Tony for Hedwig and the Angry Inch. Mm.
Yes. All right, we're going to play this one, and big thanks, Holly.
Thank you
for having me. This was fun.
All right, take a listen to this. We'll be back right on the other side.